Welcome to episode 79 of Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast dedicated to Central and Eastern Europe and the official podcast of the New Eastern Europe magazine. My name is Maciek Makulski, and with me is the other co-host, Adam Reichardt. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Maciek. Hello, everybody, and glad to have you here for another episode of the podcast. Each week, we bring you a discussion on topics related to our region of Central and Eastern Europe. And in this episode, we are looking at recent developments in Ukraine's foreign policy. As a reminder, the podcast is listener-supported. Our patrons donate monthly to support the production and development of the podcast. If you would like to support us, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/talkeasterneurope. And don't forget to listen till the end of this podcast for our traditional patron shout-out.
And Talk Eastern Europe is a member of the Europod Network, which is a network of European podcasts covering a range of social and political issues.
Great. We have a lot to cover today, so let's get started.
Okay, as Adam mentioned already, in this episode, we are looking at Ukraine and especially at Ukraine's foreign policy. Very recently, there were a lot of high-top political events, important events for this country. I think one of the most important developments is the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which a few days ago actually was completed. So this opens a new chapter, not only for Ukraine, but also for the entire region, Poland included. But of course, it has direct consequences for Ukraine, and in a way, Ukraine is the country which is the most like targeted with kind of negative consequences of this project. On the other hand, and I think it's related with Nord Stream 2, there was also President Zelensky visit in the United States.
Yes,
he visited Washington on September 1st. I think there were discussions, a lot of discussions about what is the future for Ukraine in the light of Nord Stream 2 close to operate. But also, I would like to mention that there is also an important anniversary because Ukraine celebrates 30 years of independence this year. So I think all those events create kind of an interesting context for discussion about Ukraine. I'm not sure, Adam, if you can agree with me on that.
Absolutely. And I think that one more which I would add here is the launch of the Crimea Platform Initiative, which took place with a high-level summit at the end of August. So really, I mean, I think a blitz of foreign policy initiatives, which peaked with Zelensky's visit in the White House on September 1st. But I think, as you mentioned, you know, one of the biggest context of all of these discussions and foreign policy promotion of Ukraine, which Zelensky was doing these past few months and past few weeks, is the situation of Nord Stream 2 as well, as you mentioned. And it is now going to be up and running, and it's the question is really how it will affect the security situation, the energy security situation in the region. But particularly, I think Ukraine is quite concerned that that a new leverage Russia has over the country.
Yeah, and things happen very quickly right now because Russia announced that they want to have Nord Stream 2 working even this year, this fall or this winter, we'll see. And what I have heard from some energy experts, it's not impossible. So it might happen. So this new phase of this situation will start really soon.
Yeah, and it was it was quite surprising that Angela Merkel, when she went to Washington earlier this summer, convinced the administration, the Biden administration, to basically let it happen. And then she went to Russia and she met with Vladimir Putin. This is, you know, kind of the last visits of Angela Merkel because she's leaving. And this is not a podcast on Germany, which I'm sure we will have after the elections, because I'm really interested to see what happens there. But what's most important in this context is that she met and then she came to Ukraine to meet with Zelensky right before the Crimea Platform Summit, I will add, to basically say that they have guarantees from the Kremlin that even if the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is active, there will be, you know, support for Ukraine and that the gas will still flow, because the amount of money that Ukraine receives as a result of transit of gas from Russia to Europe is a huge part of its state budget.
Yeah, of course, we will discuss Germany soon. But I also think that the situation around Nord Stream 2 also deserves a separate episode, because, yeah, I'm still interested how, what are the details about how this gas pipeline will work and what kind of, you know, requirements the company will have to meet, because you know, it's not that simple, and I think still there it requires some discussion, some explanations, and we also should have broader knowledge what kind of consequences now we will face.
Yeah, and we had a discussion with Wojciech Jakubik, I think, last year, energy expert. Still
valid, of course.
It's still valid, yeah. That was at a point where we weren't sure if it will be completed or not, but I think we can link to that episode here if anyone wants some background information, the kind of pre launch of the pipeline. So we can include that in the show notes.
But Adam, I also very shortly wanted to ask you about this Crimea platform, because you had occasion to go to Kyiv when the summit was taking place. So
yes,
you were at the spot.
I was.
So we cannot miss the opportunity to get some insights and your input, but maybe the most general question: do you think that it was a success of Zelensky and his team? And part of this question is also that you think that this platform has a potential to, you know, to help Ukraine achieve their the goals around the Crimea and
I do get into this in the interview later as well, but I just share briefly some of my initial reactions. I think the summit itself was a success. I think we can check this as a success for Zelensky and his foreign policy, because he brought together over 40 countries represented during the summit, and many of them were heads of states particularly from the region of Central and Eastern Europe. But what it really does is bringing the topic of Crimea back on the international agenda. And I think it also, you know, gets reassurances that the international community does not recognize and will not recognize the annexation of Crimea. And I think that's really, you know, important message to Russia as well, which I think Russia would like to put the Crimea question away and just move on and try to repair its relations with the West, which is, you know, a huge challenge anyway. And I think Zelensky's maneuver was quite successful in stopping that. So, you know, what I think about when I, you know, obviously, the return of Crimea to Ukraine is a huge question, and it's going to require a lot of work, and a lot of factors need to come into place. And from today's perspective, we don't really see it happening. But I think of it similar to the Baltic states when they were incorporated into the Soviet Union. Like, for example, the United States never recognized the Baltic states as republics in the Soviet Union. And so I think, you know, in this sense, you have kind of this precedent for not recognizing such annexation, which will leave the door open in the future for when the situation is right, that Crimea could be incorporated back into Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So this is also, this Crimea platform is also kind of a machine that can help Ukraine to keep a certain narrative about this, about Crimea alive,
And, yes, exactly.
And
they have a couple different initiatives within the project. There's an expert platform, which I think brings together experts to do analysis. You know, there will be constant communication on certain types of issues, including the human rights situation. So yeah, this is like you said, it's like kind of a machine or a tool to keep Ukraine and Crimea in on the international agenda.
So lastly, very short, this kind of summits will be held on a regular basis right now, or it will rather turn into like smaller summits, smaller conferences of, I don't know, different groups, branches, and people?
Yeah, that was a little unclear how it will go forward at the end of at the conclusion of this summit. I think yes, it'll be much more on a lower level. I don't expect, maybe they will, but I don't expect them to be organizing high level summits on an annual basis. So we will see. We will see. It's still an evolving process.
As you said, more information about Crimea Platform you will hear in the interview. So maybe, yes, Adam, now is a good time to introduce our guest speaker.
Sure. I caught up recently with Anna Korbut, who's an expert on Ukraine. She previously has been a fellow with Chatham House, and she is also previously a journalist from Ukraine, and she has been on the podcast before, so some of you may recognize her voice. And we absolutely talked about these types of issues. So I asked her for her commentary and analysis on Zelensky's visit to the White House, the Crimea Platform Initiative, Nord Stream 2, and many more issues. So I think maybe with that, Maciek, we can go straight now into our interview. Joining me now is Anna Korbut, who is a Ukrainian journalist and analyst of Ukrainian politics and media. Anna, thanks so much for coming back to Talk Eastern Europe.
Thanks for having me again.
So I wanted to start with probably the biggest news at the moment, at least, and that's the visit of Volodymyr Zelensky in the United States. He just finished a meeting with the U.S. President Joe Biden. So maybe we could start a little bit with your reaction on Zelensky's visit to Washington. Obviously, prior to the trip, one of the most concerning developments has been the fact that the Biden administration kind of gave up its opposition to Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Many commentators have said that this was the American abandonment of Ukraine. What do you think Zelensky has aimed to achieve with this visit to the U.S.? And how do you interpret these first signals from the joint statement and already some of the visits that have been taking place?
Well, I would say that Zelensky's visit to Washington is part of his efforts, of his administration's efforts to keep Ukraine high on the international agenda, especially now that there are some changes in the international agenda, both in terms of the change of administration in the U.S., the upcoming changes of governments, for example, in Germany, so some elections. And generally, Zelensky and his team, just like I would say Poroshenko and his team, have been throughout the years pretty active on the diplomatic front, on the international, on Ukraine's international efforts, especially aimed at keeping cooperation and communication active with the key partners, the key allies, of which the U.S. is one. This visit was rescheduled several times, and that has caused different comments in Ukraine, from critical to, well, it's no big deal. I would say that in terms of how successful this visit was, there have been some specific things signed. For example, Ukraine signed with the U.S. An agreement to build to expand some nuclear power generation capacity. Ukraine also signed an agreement on strategic partnership with the U.S. In terms of how much substance there will be in that, I would say that we will see that in the process. It's a bit of an obvious thing to say, but I would watch how these things are filled with substance after the visit. Mm-hmm. There were some highlights in the visit, and clearly one of them was Nord Stream 2, and we can talk about that a bit later. Another one was Ukraine Like a lot of people compare Ukraine to, say, Afghanistan, and the fact that the US, that Washington is withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, and we've seen how a bit hectically that has been happening. So Ukraine wants to seek some sort of assurances or to see some sort of signals that the support for Ukraine is not wavering on part of the US. And from what we know from the statements, Zelensky and Biden have discussed also the Normandy format, the Russia's aggression against Ukraine. And so Biden has been pretty clear about what they expect, what he expects from Russia, and that is to comply with its commitments, whether or not it will do it. Probably not, but this is this is what we've heard.
Yeah.
And then clearly Zelensky met with representatives of the Congress. There were meetings, as far as we know for now, there were meetings scheduled with representatives of big American business, IT. So it was, it was a comprehensive visit. It was a visit of both PR as well as substance. But how this substance will materialize eventually, we will see after the visit.
You mentioned the Normandy format. I know that Zelensky, I think, is one of his things that he's been saying since he's been elected president is he would like to expand the format and maybe even include the U.S. as one of the members of the Normandy format. Is there any likely possibility that this could happen? I mean, I mentioned right now, I think it's Ukraine, it's Russia, France, and Germany, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, the U.S. has not shown any direct expressed interest in joining the Normandy format specifically. So I think most likely it will remain a player outside of the Normandy format that will have certain influence on how things play out, on the sanctions policy and interaction with its European allies.
Maybe we can come back a little bit more to this when we talk about the situation in Ukraine. But I did want to also ask a bit about more about Nord Stream 2 in particular, because this was one of the issues that has been kind of in the headlines the last several months before even Zelensky's visit to the U.S. In particular, was after Biden met with Angela Merkel. Biden announced that they will no longer sanction or try to stop the operation of Nord Stream 2 from being completed. And Merkel then went to Moscow, and there was kind of a similar attitude that Nord Stream 2 is going to be done, and there's no more anything that can be done to stop it. Can you, for our listeners, maybe can you explain, for example, first, how the Ukraine and the Ukrainian government reacted to this news, and also maybe explain why Nord Stream 2 is such the development and the operation Nord Stream 2, why what it means for Ukraine, and what are some potential scenarios for the country?
There has been a lot of talk about Nord Stream 2, lately, in the past couple of months. In terms of the general reaction, I would describe it as disappointment, but also an expected disappointment in Ukraine, as well as I'm sure in Poland, given that we have seen Germany's perseverance in pushing for Nord Stream 2 to be completed. And then Joe Biden, everybody expected him to try and fix the transatlantic relations, or specifically relations between the US and Germany, after Donald Trump. So it was an expected outcome in a way.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, clearly Ukraine, just like a number of other Eastern and Central European countries, especially Poland, that will be affected or that have been affected by Nord Stream 2 and generally by Russia's, we could say, gas wars or gas problems.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, they will not. They will not, or they were not planning to give up on countering the project on different levels and as much as they could. So there was continued effort to stall the process or to speak to European and American allies about how it threatens energy and physical security of these countries, both Ukraine and Poland as well. In Ukraine, there is also cautious skepticism or realism, cautious realism about the pledges that Germany and the US have mentioned in support of Ukraine's energy and physical security in this context. So what that means is that Ukraine seems ready to use whatever pragmatic, realistic instruments are available as leverage against Russia's potentially abusive gas politics in Europe. So, and this is something that Poland has done already, for example, with through courts, using the conditions of the third energy package. And also the thing that Ukraine is trying to incorporate into its toolkit. So the realistic, pragmatic leverage. In terms of, so politically, like in more detail, on the political level, for example, there was an interview with Reuters from Yuri Vitrenko, who is head of Ukraine's Naftogaz. And he said, actually, I think when he accompanied Zelensky on his trip to Washington, that it was still not too late for the US and Germany to block Nord Stream 2. This is a political statement. He was calling on Joe Biden to scrap a sanctions waiver for the project and underscoring, highlighting that this is not so much about money for Ukraine, but about security, although this is about money as well.
Yeah.
Then on the political level as well, Ukraine wants guarantees to ensure that there is the physical flow of gas through Ukraine continues, because that means, and here we're talking about potential scenarios that are talked about in Ukraine, that means that Russia will have fewer reasons to further its aggression against Ukraine, military or physical aggression against Ukraine, if it has its gas flowing through Ukraine. And then another risk, of course, is energy security. If Russia, which is quite likely, stops transit or supply of gas through to Ukraine, Ukraine will have to rely on reverse gas supplies from other European countries. And that, I mean, if there is a shortage of gas supply to these countries, they will prioritize their own customers and their own energy security over Ukraine's energy security. So that's that could create a problem as well. There are some in the latest developments in the between Ukraine, Germany, and the US on Nord Stream 2, as well as some other players. There have been some pragmatic or realistic developments and some potentially optimistic, but that also depends on how things go in the future. So on this pragmatic or realistic level, Ukraine has some assurances from Germany and the US. For example, Germany has pledged to apply available leverage to continue gas transit through Ukraine for another 10 years, so between Ukraine and Russia. And the US pledged to support that effort. This, on the one hand, this could benefit Ukraine, but it's there is a lot of skepticism in Ukraine about whether this, whether Germany would do this or whether it could realistically do it.
Yeah.
Then another pledge was about sanctions or new sanctions against Russia if it tries to use gas transit as a weapon against Ukraine. So to limit its energy security or to expand its aggression against Ukraine. And exactly in yesterday's, well, in the meeting with Joe Biden, Biden pledged to launch or expand sanctions against Russia if it abuses the gas transit or supplies weapons. But realistically, it has to be seen. And so there is some skepticism in Ukraine about that as well, given past experiences also with the Budapest Memorandum and so assurances like that. Then there is pledges on reverse gas supply. So Germany has pledged to help Ukraine enhance gas reverse capacities to boost its resilience against potential problems with gas supply caused by Russia. But this is seen with skepticism as well, because there is previous experience of gas wars from 2008-2009. So in terms of from the realistic perspectives and the leverage, the tools that Ukraine can use to protect itself and about which it can interact with Germany, with the US, or mostly with its European partners. It's the framework of the third energy package, which prevents monopolization and abuse of the electricity and gas market in Europe, including by big players, and the court procedures to enforce that. And one recent example was actually the verdict of the European Union Court of Justice that was launched based on a sequence of lawsuits from Germany and Poland about the gas transit and supply through OPAL, Nord Stream 1, and potentially Nord Stream 2. And so that ruling was in favor of the Polish position, clearly, and more competition, more diversity on the European market. So that is one potential tool that could be used to actually defend energy security for both Ukraine, but also for players like Poland. And then there was, so another point is energetic integration, energy integration of Ukraine into the EU, from which Ukraine could benefit in the long run, but this is a lengthy process, and gas supply and the gas supply issues can affect Ukraine in a very short term, prospect. And then Germany has pledged to support Ukraine's shift to green energy with, I think, 1 billion euro investment into that, or 1 billion euro assistance for that. The problem is that this does not compensate the loss of Ukraine from the loss of transit, but also large swathes of Ukrainian population are still do not have a high enough income to rapidly switch to unconventional green energy sources, nor is there a comprehensive state public infrastructure or program to help like people and companies with that shift. And we know from even the much wealthier countries that this shift is taking place, but it's not without problems and not without cost for both governments and consumers. So imagine that situation in Ukraine, especially after the consumers already went through a hike in gas and electricity prices after Russia's aggression against Ukraine began, and issues with both reforming the Ukraine's energy market and issues with the supply of fuels, including from Russia to Ukraine. So another spike in energy prices, it could have quite a high political and societal cost in Ukraine. So that is good in the long run. That is a good pledge and a good thing to do. But realistically, how it can be implemented in the short to midterm prospect, that could be problematic.
Yeah, and a lot of assurances, a lot of some compensation for this Nord Stream 2 project. But I think that, you know, the biggest risk, like you said, is much more short term. If Nord Stream 2 is operating, and then Russia could quickly shut off transit gas in Ukraine, or shut off all supplies to Ukraine, could cause quite a serious problem in a very short term period of time, especially if it's winter time. Yeah, this is, I think, the worst case scenario.
Exactly. And this could also become a leverage for Russia to use politically in Ukraine's domestic politics, because if the government, whoever is in power at the given moment, if they face serious energy issues, whether it's the price of heat in the winter or the price of electricity in the summer, you name it, and the average people, the consumers, the voters, feel it on their purses, then that could help, that could play in the hands of the political parties or the political players who can pledge to lower gas or electricity prices in exchange for closer relations with Russia or under whatever veil they can present it. But this could be this could also easily become a domestic political problem. and leverage for Russia.
You mentioned about Zelensky's visit to Washington as part of his kind of attempts to keep Ukraine on the international agenda. We talked a lot about now Nord Stream 2, which is also part of that as well. Another development this summer has been the launch of the Crimea Platform Initiative, which I managed to be there in Kyiv when it was when the summit was held. At the end of August. I'm just curious, maybe what do you have any initial assessments of this project, and what are your thoughts of Zelensky's aim at trying to keep Crimea, which for a long time has kind of been put on the sidelines, relatively speaking, if we think about Donbass or Nord Stream 2, even that now Crimea is trying to be brought back on the international agenda?
I generally assess this initiative quite positively. Of course, if we talk about, there can be some skepticism in seeing it as a way to return Crimea. Those are the assessments that, like, some of the skeptical assessments that I've heard. But on the other hand, I think that this initiative has a number of other goals that it can achieve. So it can kind of centralize and thus boost the rhetoric and discussion around the topics related to Crimea, whether it is topics related to security, maritime security, the militarization of the peninsula, or the blocking of the sea waters around it for both Ukraine and other countries, or it is the issue of the destruction and abuse of cultural heritage there, as well as the violation of human rights there, as well as environmental concerns. So if all of that is brought into one platform, and there is a range of topics, discussions, analysis, experts on the topic focused on one platform, or it's not centralized, focused on one platform in one source, that could actually help communicate that information more effectively and also draw more attention to the issue. One good signal is that a lot of European countries, as well as the US, Canada, some Asian countries, they have supported the initiative. So some by attending it, some by signing up to it. This does not mean that they will do something proactively, but then if Ukraine initiates proactive actions or resolutions or statements or decisions, then through the platform it could be done. It's an instrument to accomplish these things more effectively, I would say. Mm-hmm. Clearly, Ukraine is trying to draw the attention to Crimea, even though it has largely disappeared from the international agenda. The abuses of human rights continue there. So the situation we see around Crimean Tatars, especially those who have been opposing or have not accepted the annexation and occupation by Russia, they have been facing bogus jail terms, bogus court proceedings, persecutions, their families have been affected, and there's not much discussion, there's not much talk about it in international media, on international political platforms. So maybe this could help boost the talk about it and some actions about it within the toolkit that international organizations have, or within the toolkit of pressure that can be applied against Russia and its representatives on the ground.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, definitely the fact that there were so many countries that did attend, as you mentioned, or signed up, is a sign that there is still support for Ukraine's integrity or territorial integrity and sovereignty. And definitely, I think this will be, it's a renewal of a commitment from these countries that they will not recognize the Russian annexation.
Right.
But the ultimate aim of trying to deoccupy and bring it back seems to be quite long term. Do you think that there is any scenario in the next, I don't know, 20, 30 years where we could see Crimea come back to Ukraine? Or is this just the way to keep it from just not recognizing the Russian control?
I think it's both. Mm-hmm. I think it's both. If Ukraine gives up on trying to return Crimea, then nobody will do it. So it's up to Ukraine to try to do it. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who are suffering in Crimea, living in Crimea. There are a lot of people who have fled to, well, the continental Ukraine and cannot go back to see their relatives or have lost their property there. So this is unfair as well. Crimea, as it is now, is becoming a source of security problem for both Ukraine, but also for other Black Sea countries. It's not, at the end of the day, it's not just Ukraine's issue, not just Ukraine's problem. Ukraine has to be the main actor, the main proactive actor in not giving up and doing something about it. And then clearly, the things that seem unrealistic or impossible now, 20 years from now, they can be different, or 10 years from now, things can be different. So speculating about whether or not Crimea can be brought back with the current efforts, with whatever efforts, what it would take to bring Crimea back, that would be speculation, because we don't know what circumstances we will find ourselves in within 10 years.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true. And anything can happen, and a lot can change in a short period of time, as we have seen already in the last decades. As we're getting close to the end of our time, I did have a lot of questions on domestic issues, but I think I'll stick to the foreign policy issues, since that seems to be the theme of what we're talking about. Of course, all of it is related to domestic issues, since it's about Zelensky and his policies. But I wanted to ask, maybe just lastly, if you could comment about, you know, we see Zelensky strongly approaching the West and emphasizing the, you know, the relationship with either with the European Union or with the US, and Canada as well is an important player. But there has been also some emphasis being placed on strengthening relations with China, which could be in contrast to, you know, Western approach right now in terms of relations with China. So I'm curious, you know, is this some sort of multi-vector foreign policy, or is it more pragmatism trying to get some greater investments in the country? Any thoughts on Zelensky's approach to Ukrainian-Chinese relations?
Yeah, so I would say that given the trajectory, as we've been looking at the trajectory of how foreign policy objectives have developed under his presidency, I would say that he has placed, or his administration, his team, has placed a great focus on economic and trade interaction. And just having it with the West is, or Western countries, or the traditional developed countries, democratic countries, that was probably seen as limiting. And commercial and economic interaction with Russia clearly is limited. So the idea was, has been for a while, to also see and explore the third markets, what's called the third markets. And that would be both markets like China, but also markets in the Middle East, in Africa, in Latin America, potentially. In line with that focus, Ukrainian diplomatic efforts, economic diplomacy, has been focusing on a lot on finding ways, finding segments in which Ukraine could enhance trade, exports, and other types of, you would call, pragmatic interaction with third countries. And eventually, maybe that could translate into some more active political interactions, such as, for example, if you take countries in Latin America, most countries on the issue of Crimea, on the issues related to Ukraine's to the conflict between Ukraine and Russia, they vote, they either abstain or vote in favor of Russia. And partly that is that has a number of factors and reasons, but partly this is because Russia is more present there than Ukraine, both politically, historically, but also economically. So one of the ideas was to use is to use economic platform as kind of a launching pad for more effective and more Ukraine-friendly political interaction. With China, I would say that this is, I would say that the focus is mostly pragmatic. However, any commercial or economic interaction with China, as we know, based on the examples of other countries, can eventually flow into the political domain and political influence. And we have seen that already in some examples. For example, some of the activists in Ukraine who have been expressly supporting the protests in Hong Kong, they have faced backlash from both Chinese users of social media, or they've spoken about it, and backlash from the Chinese officials who were trying to influence, well, according to them, who were trying to influence, to wield some influence on Ukrainian officials so that they put pressure on these activists. Then there were news in the media about China's pressure on Ukraine to withdraw its support for the resolution on Uyghurs and their rights in return for the access to vaccines. So these things that have surfaced in the media and on social media in conversations with activists, they show that pragmatic interaction, pragmatic cooperation with players like China will not be limited to just trade or just economy. And so Zelensky's team, whether it's his presidential team or his party, should tread carefully. Enhancing cooperation and trade with China on its own does not mean that Ukraine has changed its vector to its foreign policy vector to multi-vector policy. It still declares partnership with the EU, with the US, Canada, so with the Western Bloc, as its main priority, main integration priority, main transformation priority, and main partnership priority. But I would say that the team in power in Ukraine should be careful about the ties that can result from commercial or pragmatic interaction and political influence. There has been some, there has been a lot of backlash in Ukraine from civil society, from some segments of civil society against more intense cooperation of the party in power with their representatives of different segments in China. So representatives of the media segment, representatives of the different ministries, so in different segments. There has been a backlash. So there is not necessarily a backlash against economic cooperation, but against political cooperation, yes. So it's, I would say it's a development in progress, and it's mostly based on pragmatic and economic focus, but it can have political repercussions. And about that, Ukraine's leadership has to be careful.
Yeah, I'm curious if there was maybe some closed door discussions like this also during the visit in the US. I think there's some cautious, probably, or you know, some cautions being delivered to Zelensky and his team as well in terms of strengthening ties with China. I think you're right about that. Yeah.
Well, in the previous, I think it was under the previous administration, we saw the case of Motor Siege, which with a sale, potential sale to the Chinese, that was then reversed after interaction with the US. But also it's the main thing that has to play a part in this is Ukraine's national interest, Ukraine's security interest. And when many European countries, like both US, but also many European countries are quite cautious about the security implications of having China as major investor or a major participant of their communication infrastructure, internet infrastructure, you name it, high technology, then Ukraine has to be cautious as well.
Okay, Anna, thanks so much for your input and for this discussion on the situation in Ukraine and in foreign policy especially. There's a lot of developments, and I think we will continue to be covering these topics. So thanks for joining us here.
Thank you for your interest.
And that was my interview with Anna Korbut, an expert on Ukraine. I think it was quite an interesting conversation. We have a lot of resources also available on the New Eastern Europe website, which I'm going to include in the show notes, Maciek, including some discussions on Nord Stream 2, on the Crimea platform, as well as Zelensky's visit to the U.S. So if any of you listeners out there are interested in reading more about this, I highly suggest taking a look at New Eastern Europe and some of the resources that we have here in the show notes.
Yeah, have a look on these materials. There are a lot of them. Adam, I think that one thing you already mentioned in the interview is also the necessity to look at the domestic politics on Ukraine. But it was interesting that so much happened regarding Ukraine's foreign policy, which
yes,
also includes broader regional foreign policy or international relations in the region. But looking at domestic Ukrainian politics is something that I am now really thinking about to deliver very soon at Talk Eastern Europe.
Yeah, I think, Maciek, it would be a really good idea to complement this episode with some discussions on the domestic situation. We, of course, were covering Zelensky's foreign policy, but, you know, some questions about Zelensky's popularity, some new actors emerging on the political stage inside Ukraine, what local politics may also look like. I think there are some questions here that still remain unanswered that we didn't have a chance to cover in this interview. So maybe, Maciek, this will be an idea for a very, very soon upcoming episode.
That's right. And you have always the constant element of Ukrainian politics. I mean, the oligarchs. Yeah?
So yes, that's right.
That's also something we should, I think, touch upon. But I don't have any more comments about the interview. I really like it. Thank you for that. It was, in my view, a very interesting conversation. And we also covered some issues at the beginning of this episode. So I think it's already enough.
Yes, I agree. And so maybe we can just briefly run into the announcement time of our the announcement portion of our podcast episode, which I hope all of you are still with us, because there are some important things that I would like to announce. And first and foremost is the new issue of New Eastern Europe is now available on the website. This issue is dedicated to the situation in Belarus, and it's titled Belarusians 1 Year in Protest. We really wanted to focus on the fight and the situation of the Belarusians today, after a year of the falsified elections last August. So we have, you know, an exclusive interview with Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya. We have several articles also covering things like the repressions, the sanctions policy, internet, and many, many other topics currently related to Belarus. So I highly recommend that you check it out. You can find it on our website at www.neweasterneurope.eu, but we'll have a link in the notes to the podcast as well.
Yeah, and I would like also promote our special series on Belarus we produced last year. Our regular listeners probably are already familiar with it and probably a bit tired of this announcement. But it can be still interesting for our new listeners because, it's already a year after the protests, the revolution started in Belarus. I think 1 year ago we hoped for sort of different types of the results of this pro process, but we still should be active in this field. I mean, we shouldn't forget about Belarus.
Yep.
We should be well informed about, what to say, negative developments in these countries. Yeah, including
right. Yeah, I mean, and what we try to do is we definitely want to keep the issue on our readers' agenda, and not forget about the you know, the people there and their fight for freedom and democracy.
Yeah. So please, if you have time, have a look on all the Belarus related materials we will include in the notes of this episode.
And Maciek, I think now is also a good time to say thank you, a huge thank you to our supporters of the podcast. We have monthly patrons who pay to support us, as you hear in the beginning of our of each episode, but now is the time where we say thank you personally to them with our traditional shout out. And I just want to say hello and thank you to Agnieszka, to Tom, to PM, to Eleanor, Olaf, Ian, CB, Pat, Klaus, Plamen, Sean, Naomi, JP, Elise, Sean, David, Anastasia, William, Pavel, Urs, Ian, Sophia, Wilhelm, David, Erica, Janos, Jason, Mark, Stephanie, and Pierre. Thank you so much for your support. And if you're a listener out there and you like the podcast and you have started listening to Talk Eastern Europe, please consider also giving us a monthly donation. Even $2 a month is something that helps us develop and produce the podcast.
That's right. Thank you very much for your support. Let me also add that from time to time, we also organize special closed events for our patrons. This is kind of an exclusive content available only for patrons. So you might also consider it as a something extra you might like. If you want to know more about the region we cover, meet the people, because for each we organize a discussion with guest speakers. So this is also opportunity simply to meet experts, to meet interesting people from the region.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we have had some good discussions so far. So yeah. And I think we are planning some new ones for the fall. Thanks to all of you. So stay tuned for that.
Okay, Adam, I think it's already a lot for this episode.
Yes.
As always, it was a little bit longer than I expected. Yeah, so
maybe
thank you very
thing.
Much for listening, and until next time.
Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.